Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
President Trump has said that if he's not able to work out a deal with Congress relative to the border wall, that he may exercise his right to declare a national emergency at the border and therefore be able to provide the funding necessary in order to begin construction of SANE. Joining us on the line is John Malcolm, Vice President, Institute for Constitutional Government, Director of the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies, and Senior Legal Fellow with the Heritage Foundation. John, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you.
So, John, there's a lot of talk about whether or not the president has the ability to call a national emergency specifically for this issue. Presidents have historically declared national emergencies many times and act unilaterally, and obviously they have the authority to do so. We've seen it with storms and any number of other things. Where do we stand actually on this particular issue?
Well, the president hasn't declared a national emergency. He's still trying to work it out with Congress, and of course, from a constitutional perspective, that's the safer course of action. There is such a thing as the National Emergencies Act. It's a post-Watergate law that was actually designed to curb a little bit the president's ability to declare a national emergency and to set forth the procedure that he has to follow if he does so. So if he wanted to do that, and he started to try to make a case to the American people the other day in his Oval Office speech, he would declare a national emergency, and he would then have to send to Congress that he has made that declaration, what the national emergency is, what the scope of it is, and what other laws he is relying upon in order to do what it is he wants to do, in this case, to build a wall. And I wrote an article recently in which I said, look, here are a few of the kinds of statutes that he might rely upon. One is in the Immigration and Nationality Act that basically talks about an influx of immigrants that overwhelms the system. I also referred to a couple of military statutes that say that if he is going to deploy, or in one of those statutes might deploy, the armed forces, that he can engage in military construction projects to support the armed forces. There are 130 some odd statutes on the books that say what a president can do in different circumstances if he declares a national emergency, and we'll have to wait to see whether the president makes such a declaration, and if so, which laws he relies upon to justify building a wall.
So, you know, the Democrats have been consistent in utilizing the term manufactured crisis.
Right.
And I like to go back to the basic definition, a time of intense difficulty, trouble, or danger. It seems to me when in your article you outlined any number of things from a law enforcement standpoint, having served in law enforcement for 40 years and as an elected sheriff, what you outline in your article in talking about the trials and tribulations of drugs, about the coyotes and human trafficking.
Sure.
You know, all of the challenges, the number of the increase in customs enforcement, the fact that Congress passed laws that to craft a immigration policy that will help curb this but never fund it. These are not things that President Trump did. So how did he manufacture this crisis?
Well, they're essentially, I mean, you're of course correct that the Congress has passed laws in the past, including a law in 2006 called the Secure Fence Act that basically called for a wall to be built along the southern border, but they never appropriated any funds for that purpose. I would note the 26 Democratic senators voted in favor of that legislation, including Chuck Schumer, Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton, Joe Biden, Dianne Feinstein, and a slew of of others. And you are, of course, correct. The president has pointed out that 90% of the drugs entering this country are coming along the southern border. Over the last year, there's been a 73% increase in fentanyl. That's up to 2,400 pounds of this highly deadly substance. 38% increases in the flow from methamphetamine and heroin. You pointed out that coyotes, the smuggling groups that bring migrants across the border, are making an estimated $2.5 billion a year. And these migrants are subjected to horrific conditions. Nearly 70% of them say that they've been assaulted in some form or fashion, and roughly a third of women migrants say that they were sexually assaulted. The ICE authorities and Customs and Border Patrol authorities have stopped known gang members. They've stopped adults with criminal records. And, of course, rather dramatically, the president pointed to the mayhem that has been wrought by many of the illegal immigrants who have made it into our country. He said in the last 2 years, 266,000 illegal immigrants have been charged or convicted with 100,000 assaults, 30,000 sex crimes, 4,000 murders, and the list goes on and on and on. I suppose the argument on the other side will be, yes, it's a bad situation, but it's really not much worse than it was a year or 2 years ago, and you have tried unsuccessfully to deal with Congress, and therefore you have just sort of taken what was a bad situation but hardly constitutes an invasion of our shores and are exercising these authorities in an unwarranted and, in fact, unconstitutional
fashion. So it seems to me that the Democrats are saying inaction then trumps, no pun intended, this crisis. This definition of crisis. You know, you can't – them doing nothing hasn't fueled the crisis at all. And I, what I don't understand is that – so we've had multiple years of inaction, so that just means there's not a crisis?
Well, you know, it is a little bit of a catch-22 argument, which is if you don't act for long enough, that then all of a sudden, because you didn't act, you can't declare this as a crisis.
Right.
That is the argument that they are making. It does seem to me as if the president has a fairly compelling case that the situation has gotten dramatically worse. We now have caravans showing up at our borders, 200,000 or 2,000% increase in asylum claims over the last 5 years. 800,000 case backlog with our immigration courts. And everybody knows that these family units that make it into the country, because the system is so overwhelmed, that they are rarely, if ever, removed. It's still a rather extraordinary authority if the president were to invoke a national emergency. Every time a president does so, it sets some kind of a precedent for what a future president might do in similar circumstances. All in all, it would probably be better if he could work this out with Congress. But, you know, the Democrats certainly do not appear to be budging. And so the president may well pull the trigger on this.
When you think about the notion that all of this diminishes the safety and security of respective communities, not just along the border, but throughout the country, and there's any number of anecdotal stories that we could talk about with MS-13 gang activity in
sure.
North Carolina and here, there, and towns that we would have never thought in a million years would be impacted by the southern border that they are. This law contemplate if there's stalemate in government, that somebody's got to be able to rise to the top and make a critical decision at a critical time in order to resolve the issue?
Yeah, if the factual basis is there. So Barack Obama said, look, if Congress is going to act, I'm going to use my phone and my pen. And he implemented DACA and the DAPA programs. And a lot of conservatives objected to that, saying that he was bypassing Congress and he didn't have the lawful authority to do that. So you always have to be a little bit careful whenever a president invokes significant power by bypassing Congress and acts unilaterally. In this case, though, it does seem to me that the president has a rather compelling case that the situation along the southern border has deteriorated rapidly. And so we'll see whether he takes that rather extraordinary step and what statutes he invokes in order to back it up, because it will certainly be challenged in a court of law. And there are no shortage of judges that are prepared to try to frustrate the president's agenda, as we saw with the travel ban case.
So the plaintiffs who have already started to develop their strategy, I guess, go to a friendly forum, file this in order to get one yet again a district court to file an injunction that they say handcuffs everyone across the country, which, as a lawyer, I can tell you that's not what I was taught.
Yeah, well, there has certainly been a large increase in state actions filed against this president. There were a fair number against Barack Obama, but the Democrats-led attorneys generals have dramatically eclipsed the lawsuits that were filed against President Obama, and the increase in the number of nationwide injunctions being entered to frustrate this administration is also proceeding at an unprecedented level. Clarence Thomas on the Supreme Court has voiced some concerns about this. Other judges have as well, but you know, that is part of the left's MO, is that they file a lawsuit, they seek out a friendly jurisdiction, and they're able to persuade a judge to enter a nationwide injunction so that even if the administration wins in other courts, they still can't implement their policy unless and until a higher court overrules that lower court injunction.
Inertia at all levels, just completely surprising. And meanwhile, more and more people are hurt, more and more people are killed, and our communities are placed at risk each and every day. John Malcolm with the Heritage Foundation, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate your time.
Great to be with you.
All righty. We'll be right back. We want to hear from you, 260-1870, or text us at 870-870. We'll be right back after the break. This is Newell on WWL. We're back, and on the Blue Runner opinion poll, are you for or against using emergency powers to bypass Congress to pay for the border wall? 100% of the respondents say they are for. We'll update that and give you the most current numbers. But we're on day 25 of the government shutdown, and we have a number of folks, federal employees, that continue to feel the pain and are out there going to work in some cases. And not being paid and wondering how much longer they can do so. And under the Fair Labor Standards Act that are being violated by this, that are requiring essential personnel to show up for work, air traffic controllers, any number of law enforcement agencies that are being impaired by this, we're still waiting for the adult to walk into the room with some level of intellect in order to get through this process. And, you know, and this was a very interesting article done by John Malcolm. And he lays out the case that the president could use in trying to support him declaring an emergency. And what do you do when you end up here where we are and we have stalemate? You heard John Malcolm mention two programs, DACA, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and DAPA, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans. So you will recall you can come into this country illegally. And if you have a child, the child is automatically an American, a U.S. citizen. So they created the DAPA program, Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, so that their parents would have an immediate pathway to citizenship and getting a green card and everything else. And it was done by a policy change implemented by President Obama. I received a couple of texts that said, why does he always have to, why do the Republicans always mention Obama? Well, there's relevance. That's why. I know that that's not what you want to hear, but there's relevance because you would think that if one has the authority to do it by virtue of being president, that the next president should have the authority to undo it because of that being his wish. There's no congressional action. He just did it as a policy directive. It wasn't even an executive order. This case has gone to the Supreme Court. It was a 4-4 split. So there was a tie. So that means this issue is still open space. And we've not resolved the issue yet. These series of cases, In order to get this stalemate resolved, has to work its way back through the court system and get to the United States Supreme Court, one way or the other, in order to decide this issue. Because this is one of the few things, I think, that's going to remove the stalemate where we are right now, because these two programs are the negotiating tools that are being utilized by the Democrats in order to get them an expedited path to citizenship. Now, the opponents say, well, you're rewarding bad behavior. You've got all of these people that have been playing by the rules that are waiting. And those that come across the border illegally break all the rules. You're going to create an avenue for them to get to the pot of gold, U.S. citizenship faster than ordinarily anybody would get into that. So you know that's the challenge that is exhibited here that we need to work through. Let's go to Mike on the Causeway on line two. What say you, Mike?
Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
I think there's another important factor here too.
Mm-hmm.
My belief is that Trump also has to be made aware, has to be careful not to fold, because any stalemates like this in the future will make them believe that eventually he will fold. So I think it's the wall. I know Pelosi, Obama, and Schumer are all for the wall. They're against Trump. But I do think there's another thing in negotiations with a guy like Trump, or with anybody who's a strong negotiator. You don't want to show a weakness. And this will affect everything in the future for him if he folds. And I think that's another underlying fact that must be considered, too.
No, I agree with you, Mike. I really believe that from a political perspective, he cannot fold, because then they'll have the best of him. And that's why I think he backed down on his original position of still trying to craft a compromise at some point in time, and he backed down off of that position, because I think he began to realize is that he's gutting himself. He's gutting himself at that point in time, right?
Correct. Yeah. And Newell, one more thing. I'm Mike. That was at the escalator. If you get a chance after the show, please give me a call. And listen, Newell, one more thing.
Yeah.
One more thing. Anybody who sells their tickets to an L.A. fan is it's treasonous.
Oh, that's blasphemous, man. Treasonous, blasphemous. What other word can we put on that? That would be horrible. We don't want to even talk about that.
Well, they do it.
There should not be anybody contemplating bringing the enemy into the Houdat Nation. What are you thinking about? I mean, that's the front line, right?
I think that's prison terms.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mike. We got to get to a break. If you're on hold, stay on hold. We're going to come right back to the talk lines when we return. This is Newell on WWE. On the Blue Runner opinion poll, are you for or against using emergency powers to bypass Congress to pay for the border wall? 59% of the respondents say they are in favor of that action by the president. Let's go to line two. Talk to John on the North Shore. What say you, John?
Hey, well, I would say on that subject that I would be against it only because of the precedent it sets. I do think it's a serious issue that needs to be addressed, but I think our members of Congress need to step up and do their job. And along that line, I wanted to add, I don't know how many of your listeners are aware of this, but, you know, the Coast Guard has a significant number of people in the New Orleans area. And these young men and women, a lot of which are junior enlisted people, and they don't make much money. And unlike their brothers and sisters in the Department of Defense, Marines, Air Force, and what have you, they're getting paid, but the Coast Guard dependents are not getting paid, nor is it likely that the retired military people from the Coast Guard would get paid with this government shutdown. So there's some real pain felt, and I know it's across the board. We're talking about something like 800,000 government employees that are furloughed and whatnot, and some people are impacted more than others, but I would venture to say I'd be hard-pressed to believe that anyone would be any more impacted than our junior service members within the Coast Guard. So it's time for the Congress to step up.
John, you're exactly correct. In fact, I read an article the other day about the role that the Coast Guard actually plays in immigration enforcement as well, and a lot of those have been furloughed. And, in fact, a number of folks coming in on the West Coast around the border wall in boats and makeshift vessels has been on the rise in this past year. And the same on the eastern seaboard. Those coming from Haiti and other areas like that are dealt with by the Coast Guard. And a number of the non-essentials that you're talking about, they are not getting paid, and they are definitely on furlough.
Right. And, you know, I'm a retired Coast Guard officer. I was enlisted and spent a good time of my career patrolling the Caribbean, picking up Cubans in the Florida Straits and Haitians coming across. Now, those people were political refugees.
That was different. You're right.
Yeah. And we went out. We did our job. So I've looked at it. I've smelt it. I don't know how many bowls of rice and beans that I've passed out to Cubans and Haitians trying to do things to get their family truly out of a depressed area. But when we're talking about people that, well, first off, I'm not from South America. I hadn't spent much time down there, and I don't want to sit there and pretend like I know what a hardship is, but I've seen it with my own eyes and ears. And from what I've seen, whether it's fake news or whatever you want to call it, those situations, at worst, any of the people that I was associated with in picking up Cubans or Haitians would have loved to have that, you know, coming across in rafts with babies and, you know, threatening, truly risking their life to better their family. I have a big
Well, the fact of the that. Matter, the fact of the matter, John, is I think the plight, you know, from the Haitians and the Cubans was you know, politically driven in many respects, unlike what's going on the southern border. Heck, there are any number of communities within its own country that would ask for the same relief that they're asking for from distressed economic conditions.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well,
you know, and that's the way I kind of anyway. Try to square this up. Where do our own citizens apply for asylum? You know, and are we going to pay to move them from where they're down and out circumstances within our borders to someplace better or a state that
right.
has, you know, a much better support system for the working poor or the true poor? You
yeah.
know, I mean,
well, you know, in the case of Cuba, and I don't want to take up too much of your time, Janet Reno, when she was Clinton's attorney general, they changed the policy for Cubans to come in to where actually there's a feet dry policy that if any Cuban, a political refugee's feet hit land, they were automatically introduced into our country without any other process. And I was the unfortunate person under Janet Reno's administration that anyone caught American citizen trying to assist Cubans into the United States would be dealt with harshly. Well, lo and behold, I was a boarding officer of the very first case about 75 miles south of Key West that picked up a U.S. master bringing a male and a female across the border. And, you know, on the one hand, you know, I felt for him, but on the other hand, I'd sworn an oath to
no, absolutely. You had to do what
US
you had
government.
To do. Absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, John, thanks so much for calling. I got to get to a break. I apologize. I appreciate your insight. Have a great day. We will be right back after the break. Stay with us. Give us a call, 260-1870, or text us at 870-870. This is Newell on WWF. We're back, and Dave Cohen, WWL's news director, joins us in the studio with some news from out at the fairgrounds, the home of the New Orleans Jazz and Heritage Festival.
Yes, not surprisingly, the Rolling Stones are going to be playing the 50th Jazz Fest, one of the worst-kept secrets in a long time. But we also learned today that Katy Perry will be headlining the Jazz Fest, Dave Matthews Band, Jimmy Buffett, Chris Stapleton, Alanis Morissette, Bob Seger and the Silver Bullet Band, Pitbull, Earth, Wind & Fire, John Fogerty, Sierra, Irma Thomas, Santana. The list goes on and on and on. Tom Jones, Bonnie Raitt, Mavis Staples, Aaron Neville, the Doobie Brothers. We have the whole
Whoa.
List up at WWL.com.
Tom Jones, now you're talking, baby.
Get your panties ready. Throw them on the stage. Somehow, you know, that guy's still at his age. Women
How old
still
is
throw.
Tom? I have no
he's
idea.
In his 70s.
He's got to be in his 70s.
And women are still throwing panties at him. I guess that never gets old. I don't know. But yeah, really, they have gone all out for this 50th anniversary. The unique thing about the day the Rolling Stones play is that they're selling a separate ticket for that day. And the way they've explained it is that they do not want to overload the fairgrounds. Their fear is apparently that because this is the only Rolling Stones ticket left, they've sold out their entire tour. And so there are no tickets to see the Stones available anywhere right now. And these will be the last tickets for the tour to go on sale. So their fear was that if they didn't cap it, if they allowed anybody with any ticket to Jazz Fest over the 8 days they're doing for this 50th anniversary, that they'd have to turn people away at the gates because it would get too crowded. So they have explained that they now will sell a limited number of tickets for that day only. They didn't say how many. They did say they expect it to sell out quickly.
And is the price going to go up?
Yeah, the price for that day is going to be different, obviously, than the price for any other day because it's a limited number of tickets. We don't have all the details yet. This news conference is continuing as we speak, but we wanted to get this information out to folks and let them know that, indeed, these are some of the groups that I've just listed that are playing at the Jazz Fest. We have the promotional video and the list that we're constantly adding to right now on our website at WWL.com. So not a bad lineup.
Do we know what day the Stones will be playing?
The Stones will perform on the first Thursday of the Jazz Fest.
Oh,
so
it's
the very first day.
It'll be a day that you know, that's not as obviously as crowded, excuse me, in the first Saturday, Sunday, second Saturday,
yeah,
Sunday.
Yeah, that will be – well, actually, okay, the Rolling Stones will play Thursday, May 2nd.
Right.
Okay, so that's the second Thursday, not the first Thursday.
Second Thursday.
Yeah.
Right.
Katy Perry will perform April 27th, and they have not given us the list of all of the performers, the times and dates as of yet. But again, this is happening as we speak, so we'll continue to update it on our website at WWL.com and here on the air.
Big news from the Jazz Fest, all-star lineup for sure. A lot of my favorite bands, I mean, just about almost every one of them. Maybe not Tom Jones, but we know there are fans out there for
Tom Jones.
So
you'll camp out for 8 days at the fairgrounds.
Right. I won't be at the Tom Jones thing. But anyway, all right, we got to get to a break. We'll be right back afterwards. Stay with us, 260-1870, or text us at 870-870. We'll be right back. This is Newell on WWL. There was an article done back when the Saints played the Rams, and the Rams said the crowd noise for New Orleans fans did not play a factor in this game. What did play a factor was the advantage home field was given by the refs to the Saints. So they're saying that the only reason we beat them was because of the refs, not anything else. Not sure about that. Let's go to line one, talk to Billy. What say you, Billy?
Hey, Newell, how's it going, my man?
Doing great, man.
Yeah, listen. Well, I feel like the Houdat Nation, I need them to back me up right now.
All right.
Because with all the noise that they made in that game, that pulled us through and we won. So right now, I'm holding a ticket that I went to Vegas in May and purchased at the Caesars Sports Palace. And I put $40 down on the Saints to win the Super Bowl at 14-1.
Okay.
And right now the magic number is 2.
Absolutely.
And so all I need is the Houdat Nation this week coming is to stand up again and make that noise again, and that'll get me into Atlanta. And for 2 weeks, we can run around Atlanta and on every bar, every news station and stuff, class the New Orleans Saints.
Yeah, I want to find that. I want to find that mayor. I think we need to find that mayor.
Oh, she's going to be upset. She's going to be upset when we show up down there and play, win the Super Bowl, and I get to put over that $600 in my pocket.
There you go, Billy.
I'll take that $600, keep it in my pocket, spend a little money, but I'll bring that $600 home and celebrate when I get
home.
Well,
why don't you pre-spend that $600, wear some bling to the game, bring your game voice, and spread the wealth and see if you can help bring it home. You going to the game?
Oh, yeah. No, I'm going to find a local bar around here on the West Bank someplace to go down there and sit, pick up a big cigar, and scream as loud as we can outside so they can hear it at the dome.
All righty, Billy, I appreciate it. Got to get now to the cash contest. I want to find out where the big pep rally is going to be, and we want to hit 140 on the audible meter. 140 is like standing next to a jet on an aircraft carrier. Got to do that.
All right, football fans, the NFL draft is almost here, and the Free Odyssey app brings you the latest coverage from the biggest sports radio stations across the country. Which players will help your team the most? Who will make a draft day trade? Will they be ready for week one? The local conversations about the team you love. All streaming free right here on the Odyssey app. AUDACY. Download it today.